Welcome to the second episode of the Global History Podcast with me, Chase Caldwell-Smith. Today, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to Professor Dr. Sebastian Conrad, who holds the chair of modern history at Freie Universität Berlin. Professor Conrad has a background in both modern European and Japanese history, and his recent work has extensively explored transnational and global approaches to studying the past. His publications include German Colonialism, A Short History, Globalization and the Nation in Imperial Germany, and The Quest for the Lost Nation, Writing History in Germany and Japan in the American Century. On this episode, we'll be discussing Professor Conrad's well-known critical approach toward the burgeoning discipline of global history, called What is Global History?, published by Princeton University Press in 2016. So far translated into Chinese, Spanish, Russian, and Estonian, and with further translations into Turkish, Portuguese, and Japanese under contract, this is a book that has resonated with academic communities around the world. So how does one go about writing the history of the world? And who is global history written by, and for whom? Listen on to find out more. If you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com, message us on Facebook, or tweet us at the Global History Podcast. Good afternoon, Sebastian. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Good afternoon.
So to begin this interview, I'd like to ask you a bit about your personal journey in how you came to write What is Global History? So I was thinking, I wanted to ask, how did you come to conceptualize this work, and how did it grow out of your earlier work and your own intellectual journey?
Mm-hmm. Right. You have a day or two for this question.
Yeah.
I can start. I could give you a very long answer, but let me try to come up with something a little shorter. So essentially, I mean, on the one hand, one could say global history is definitely not my invention. It's something that's out there. Many scholars are thinking about it, working in this field. So in that sense, it is the product in some ways of its time. It's also the expression of a certain zeitgeist. It's an attempt to think through the ways in which we need to make sense of the past in an age that is globalizing, rapidly globalizing, and where we increasingly have the sense that our earlier ways of dealing with history no longer really accord well with our present. That would be the more general answer. My sort of, in terms of my own academic or intellectual biography, it is easy for me to at least see it as the almost logical result of my earlier work. We all tend to retrospectively create these homogeneous biographies, but my earlier work was on Japanese history and also in the field of German history. And for a long time, I have been thinking about ways of bringing these various fields together. I started out with a work that was comparative, that then gradually changed more and more into what I would now call a transnational study of how German and Japanese historians, in particular after 1945, reconceptualized their nation's history. And in a second book that I wrote on German nationalism, I thought about German nationalism as something that was not produced or created only within Germany, but was to a large degree a response to global challenges. Essentially, for a long time in my own work, I've tried to link these different fields of interest and found global history just a very capacious framework within which to think. At an earlier stage, post-colonial studies did a lot to help me integrate these two fields, integrate my interest in Asian history, interest in colonial history, and interest in German history. That was also very efficient. But over the past 10 years or so, I also came to recognize increasingly the potential limits of a post-colonial approach, and therefore global history seemed to just offer that space to think about these issues in a new way.
That's really interesting. Thank you. So you mentioned some of these other approaches that you've used. I was curious to ask, to what extent does your approach to global history, or your conceptualization of global history as an approach, rather, to what extent does it draw upon these earlier ways of viewing the world, and to what extent is it a rupture with them?
Mm-hmm. I see, yes. So I think in terms of approaches that have emerged in the past, let's say, 30, 40, three decades, four decades or so, there's no doubt that this newer approach of global history, and also my own understanding of it, really builds on these earlier approaches. And that includes, for example, world systems theory. Obviously, I don't embrace world systems theory wholly, but at the same time, it really has offered insights that we can still use. And the same is also true for postcolonial studies. In my own understanding of global history, postcolonial studies plays a very crucial role. And I say this, and I underline this also, because many colleagues in the field of, you know, world and global history writing, they see world history, global history, rather as a strategy to move away from postcolonial studies, move out of some of the concerns of this earlier paradigm. While I tend to think that a good global history needs to include postcolonial perspectives, otherwise it wouldn't be attuned to the hierarchies and power differentials at work. So if this is how you intended the question, then I would say, yes, there is an interaction between these different approaches and global history needs to build on them. Or did you mean your question in a much sort of broader and long durée kind of sense, such that one would, for example, say, historians have always written the history of the world. It starts with Thucydides and Herodotus, and then it goes all the way up to the present. And these earlier, for example, Enlightenment historiography was also very cosmopolitan or worldly. And these earlier instantiations also have an impact on what we do today. That would be an entirely different question.
Well, I'm quite interested in that as well. I was wondering if you could please elaborate on that, that kind of genealogy of the history of global history itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the current wave of global history would seem to be simply or merely the most recent instantiation of a concern that historians have always had, namely to place societies in broader context. And they would essentially claim that ever since Herodotus, in the European context, but also in other societies and cultural contexts, historians have always, in some ways, written about larger contexts and about the world, whatever they saw as the world at that particular time. And there is also something to this, but here I would actually be much more cautious, and I would say that global history, as it has emerged over the past two, three decades, is much more a new beginning than a continuation or reformulation of these earlier attempts. It is much more a response to the process of globalization that we witness and experience today than it is in continuity with these earlier formulations that responded to very different kinds of contexts. The response, let's say, for example, to the Enlightenment world of the late 18th century is clearly not the context within which we think. We don't live in an age of empire, slavery, the beginning of the ideology of free trade and so forth. So therefore, our own perspective is bound to be a very different one.
I think so, absolutely. I was interested in some of the terminologies you use in your book. And you do admit at one point that many historians use, for example, the terms world history and global history interchangeably. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask, how far do you believe that the analytical approaches and the terms we use need to be rigorously defined? Is there room for perhaps capaciousness within these categories and diversity? Or do you think that, for example, defining global history as an approach, as you do in your book, ought to be perhaps more finite?
Yeah, well, in some ways I'll be arguing against my own book when I now say that I think in general we should be embracing these different approaches that nevertheless can be seen as part of a family, maybe, rather than as competitors. So I have, for example, I have this colleague here in Berlin who is really invested in the term translocal, arguing that many of these processes are not global / planetary in scope. But instead, and they don't even link nation states or national societies, but they actually are much more connected. They essentially are about connections between nodal points or locality. So translocal, therefore. And if I then look at what she's doing, then this is very similar to what I would call global history. So therefore, my sense is that much of this is also very much depends on your institutional context in some places it just, it also depends on the period that you work on, it depends on the regions that you have in mind. I, in other words, wouldn't be rigid about what particular term I use. So in most cases, I would also use global really as an umbrella term, as a very general term that helps bring these various approaches together. I do, however, think that we can still make a difference between a broad, we can call it, you know, a political call to arms. Let's all do, you know, when I say global, on the one hand, I essentially mean, let's all move away from a narrow, limited national history. And in that respect, there's no huge difference between the various approaches that we've just talked about. But it is also possible to identify something that I call a distinct approach, a much more sort of, well, rigid, or let's call it systematic approach towards global history. And I do think it has its value, because ultimately, at some point, we'll all, I think, the discipline will gradually move away from history in a narrow nation-state framework. And then the question would be, is everything then global? And therefore, I think it does make sense to create this differentiation.
I think you've touched on a lot of very fascinating points there, and perhaps we can address some of them in more detail now. I was interested in your mentioning of the nation state in particular. So There was one particular sentence in your book that I thought was really fascinating. You said that global history is not about consigning the nation/nation state to the dustbin of history, but rather about reassessing its historical role and better explaining its emergence and significance. So is global history always opposed to history written on national lines or through national lines? Or do you think there can potentially be an opportunity for more cooperation as well?
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. So I'm not at all against, I mean, I have written a book myself on the subject of German nationalism. So it would be, you know, I would score an own goal if I now said this is no longer relevant. In fact, I think the main difference now is that scholars of nationalism, of nation formation, of nation building and so forth, they don't start with the assumption of the nation and its boundaries, but they see it increasingly also as an effect or as a response to global challenges. But that said, that does, of course, not mean that nation states did not form, that nation states did not have an impact on the populations that they included and governed. It does not mean that not many of the institutions that also provide the material that we use, and that includes the parliaments, it also includes the archives. Most of the archives are organized along national lines. So it does mean that much of the material, but also much of the social experience of historical actors was formed through nations and nation states. And that definitely cannot be ignored. I think the major deviation from earlier scholarship is really to see nations as not so much the outflow and product of particular national path. In the German context, the typical term that was used was Sonderweg, sometimes translated as a deviant path into modernity. But we have all kinds of exceptionalisms of this kind written into the national historiographies all over the world. So instead of starting there, instead to look at the much larger configuration that produced nationalisms, nation states around the world virtually at the same moment, that I think is the major gain of this book perspective.
I think the other point you just touched on as well was institutional structure, which is a point that I find really interesting. It's so diverse, and I think that the way institutions and universities are structured really has a sense in how academics fashion themselves in terms of their subject areas and what they approach and how they teach. So I think I have several questions in this area. One of them is, how do you think global history is best taught at universities? So I'm interested in labels particularly applied to various courses. So you teach the course at the Free University of Berlin called the MA in Global History. I just finished the course at Oxford called the MSD in Global and Imperial History. And at Cambridge, the course is called the MPhil in World History. At least in my case at Oxford, I had the sense that the course, despite its methodological aims, tended to serve as a practical grouping together of master's students working on non-European or American histories. And quoting from the admissions page, the Oxford course is, quote, open to all students who have the desire to explore the history of the Middle East, Africa, South Asia, East Asia, Australasia, or the Americas, excluding the US in a global perspective. So I was wondering, it's very interesting. So I was wondering if you could...
Excluding the US is part of the quote or is your addition to it?
No, it is part of the quote, actually.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, no, that's very interesting.
Sorry, I kind of got away from the question there. So I was wondering, how do you think that global history fits into the current institutional structure? And how do you think it's best taught within these various structures?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for the question. And also by pointing to these different programs and their different names, you already show that it depends so much on the institutional context in which these programs are situated. So for example, a program in global and imperial history would not go very well in the German context, that's for sure. I think it wouldn't even be admitted, I suspect. But so first of all, yes, it is crucially important where this program is situated. So for example, in the German context where I operate, history departments are typically, and this is true for essentially all continental European countries, history departments are about one's own country's history, period. So that essentially means that in the course catalog, there may be your odd reference to British history or maybe the French Revolution, but in principle, it is about German history. And if you go to Italy, it'll be about Italian history. In France, it'll be about French history and so forth. So in this kind of context where the histories of other parts of the world are essentially relegated to area studies departments, in this context, it is crucially important to just essentially bring these together. And therefore, so that is one of the major institutional impacts that a program like the one in which I teach has been able to bring about. This is probably different in, for example, in the United States, where most of the area studies historians are also affiliated with the history department. So you would almost automatically as a student also take courses in maybe Chinese, African, whatever history, even if you studied Europe or the US. So it does make a difference where this is situated. The second point I would like to make is this, these global world, whatever programs, they also differ in the way in which they're organized. So the philosophy of the program that I'm involved in here in Berlin is that we want to train historians who, yes, do know something about, you know, global contexts, global processes, but at the same time, we also ask and encourage the students to focus on a particular area. In other words, the idea is not to train historians who could almost as if they were looking from the moon onto the earth, you know, say something about everywhere. But rather, that they would be trained essentially in a particular place, which also includes knowing the language, being able to read the secondary literature in that language, and then to look at that place in global context and with a global perspective. Now, in other words, it's a marriage of an area studies paradigm with a global history paradigm. And I think that's actually very important. And I see differences here if you look at global history master programs in other parts of the world, where frequently the focus is, for example, on international relations or on economic integration. In other words, it is much less place-based, but more, how should I say, planetary maybe in approach. And I see that as a crucial difference.
I think you also touch on a very important point there, which is this need and perhaps also critique of global history in that it perhaps doesn't always maintain specificity. So I was curious for you, do you think that this focus on a specific area with regard to your students, do you think that this is one way that global historians can maintain specificity in their work, for example, with regard to local particularities or individual agency?
Absolutely. So the aim clearly should not be to do away with, you know, studies of particular places, to do away with micro studies, to do away with systematic studies of a society, but just to frame them differently and also to be able to recognize that some of the causality, some of the reasons for change, some of the connections within which change happens, that they clearly cross boundaries and are much broader than this society itself. But it is crucial, I think, for global historians to remain tied to a specific place. Yes, we do need one or the other overview works, like the books by Chris Bailey and Jürgen Ostermel on the 19th century. I mean, there's not only a need for it, but also a demand. But even these two books, they do show, and I think benefit from, the fact that, for example, Bailey, he's an expert in a particular part of the world. I mean, he knows South Asia probably better than any other place. And one can see that his work is also written from that perspective. And I think it does benefit from it. So instead of creating abstract bird's eye views of the planet, we need these much more specific perspectives. So to be more specific in terms of your question, I think where global history will move is, yes, it will fulfill this demand for the overview work, for the synthesis work that also a broader reading public demands. But at the same time, I think if we look down the road another 10 years or so, I don't think global history will go away, but it will be much more about the specific, about place-based, about obstacles of travel, about incompatibilities in the transfer of ideas and so forth. We've seen a first phase, let's call it the gold digger phase of global history, where everyone is essentially busy with celebrating the connections, with fetishizing the mobility of everyone and everything. And I think increasingly the historians will want to link that to, well, studies that are essentially more, that recognize difference, specificity, particularity much more.
I think you touched on a really important point there, which is this approach to connections which you take in your book, which I think that you're relatively critical in your book about historians who take connections as the finishing point of their research rather than just the beginning. So I was curious, how do you think connections are best approached by global historians? Is it time to move beyond studies focused on connections between different places? Or do you think that there's a more critical approach we can take to them?
Yeah, I suspect the latter. So definitely it's not time to move beyond connections. Connections will remain crucial, also because otherwise there would be one can easily see historians arguing by using broad categories like, structure and capitalism and so forth, irrespective of the fact that most of these structures are themselves the product of concrete interactions, exchange, connections. So I think we need to look at these connections. But the analytical position that these connections occupy in many studies is not always very clear. So there are many works that essentially, just discover a surprising connection, and that is almost the end of the story. But the question that we would have to ask is, first of all, to what extent is this connection ephemeral? Is it something that has an impact? Is it causal for other changes? So that is one. But the second question that I think increasingly historians will ask is, they will move away from the supposition or assumption that these connections themselves, so essentially by locating connections, we've already explained something. That, I think, is what many works in global history at this point are still assuming, or at least suggesting, maybe even implicitly. So once we've established a connection, there is almost the intuitive assumption that that explains something. But frequently, I think what needs to be explained is not so much the effect of the connection, but the connection itself. That is, for example, somebody reads a book that was written by a Chinese scholar, reads the book in the US. Does it mean that it changed something, or is it more interesting and more important to understand why this book suddenly becomes available, why it is now translated, why it seems to have resonance for the American reader? So the question is less what do these connections prove, but rather how can we explain the possibility of their emergence?
Thank you. I think that's really interesting. I'd also like to move towards a different area as well. So I'm interested in your claim in your book that a historical place, a period or an event perhaps, can be more or less global. And I suppose this gets to the question of whether global history as an approach can or should be used in all historical places, periods and locations. I'm curious, what are the implications of this claim? And how can a place or period's level of being global be measured? What kind of metrics would we use for this?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So it's two questions, right? One is the measurability, the other is essentially periodizing global history. I think as far as the measurability is concerned, I mean, this is something that cannot be simply measured. It is probably possible to quantify some of these processes. One example would be the integration of labor markets or also of commodity markets. One could probably arrive at a fairly good, even numerical assessment of how integrated such markets are, and one could compare over time. But it would be also a fallacy to imply that global history is about trade and the integration of markets only. There are also phases in history where it's clear that economic integration was not the most crucial driving force. But for example, someone like Sanjay Subramaniam argues that during the early, let's say, the 17th century, particular ideas, he cites millenarianism as one example, were instrumental in bridging differences between societies, between religious groups, and so forth. So, and that is much less easy to measure, obviously. So we need to, first of all, I think, come to terms with or get our heads around the question of what is it that drives global integration? And that is clearly partly the market, but it could also be empires. It can also be various forms of cultural integration and so forth. In other words, many of these dimensions are not easily measurable, and it is sort of a historian's good common sense to understand to what degree, I think, they frame or decide how social change happens. Now, let's move to the second part of the question, which is periodization. And your question is, can we do global history for any period? Does it make a difference whether we look at the 18th or the 14th century? Now, first of all, I think in principle we can use the lens of global history for any period, but the returns may be different. In other words, the potential that a global history explanation has may not be as powerful, for example, if we apply it to the ancient world. There are now many historians also of antiquity who write about ancient globalization, for example, looking at the links between Han China and the Roman Empire and so forth. And I think that's very valuable and also productive. But it is also clear that if we look at, you know, antiquity, there are many questions that if we want to turn them into global questions, they will be much less about integration, but more about comparing different developments, irrespective of whether there's connection between them. So it would be a different kind of global history, I would submit. So yes, in principle, I think it's an approach that can be employed for any period, but as a heuristic that has explanatory power, it may have decreasing returns the further back we go in time.
Yes, I think that's really important to acknowledge. This idea that even though perhaps this approach can be applied to every period, it may not necessarily be the best approach. Mm-hmm.
This is in some ways true for all approaches. And as we now discuss it, global history is very much an approach. It's not something that's out there just to be studied, but it's a lens, it's a perspective that we use, similar to other approaches like gender history, the history from below, political history, social history, and so forth. And this would be true for these approaches as well. Yes, we can, you know, use, let's say, a social history perspective for any topic and any period in principle. But there may also be questions in particular that we may want to answer where a social history approach is maybe not so powerful or not so helpful. And the same is true, I think, for global history as well.
I was wondering if you could potentially give an example of a case where global history might be a really good lens to use, and perhaps another example where it would be less fruitful to use.
There are many questions where it's very useful to use. I don't know, what should I say? Maybe I'll just mention a recent book that comes to mind where I think a global perspective opens up a lot, and I'll mention the book of my colleague Michael Goebel, who wrote on the interwar period in Paris, the 1920s in Paris, where he looks at anti-colonial nationalists from virtually every part of the world, from Morocco and Egypt, from Indochina and China, from India and the Middle East, and they all come together in Paris and they discover similarities. They discover that their own struggle seems to be part of a much larger struggle. And these interactions actually help shape their politics. So such a perspective really brings something new to a study of actors who would, in an earlier literature, be just treated as, you know, a Vietnamese nationalist or a Moroccan nationalist and essentially be compartmentalized into these national histories. So that, I think, is a wonderful example of how a global approach opens up an entirely new perspective on a topic that we thought we had already known. I don't know. Another, you know, what an example where global history approaches don't really help. If I study the processes of professionalization of a particular professional group, let's say lawyers in 18th century Lyon in France, well, probably we can add a global frame, we can add the global perspectives, but if we want to understand their strategies, the way in which they compete with other professions and so forth, well, then probably I think the global approach is not the most powerful one to use.
Okay, thank you. I think that's an interesting distinction to make. I was wondering if we could move towards a different area now. So, and talk a bit about the politics of global history and who's writing global history and for whom. So in a 2016 interview, you made the observation that some of your colleagues in India asked, is global history not a new form of intellectual imperialism? I was hoping if you could please elaborate on this concern.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. I think it's something that is a crucial question to be put to global historians. I mean, for essentially two reasons. One is global history as a discipline, as a field, let's say, really emerged primarily, has emerged in, well, the Anglophone countries, but also the global north, or what is sometimes also called the West, whatever you want to call it. That is, in countries that, maybe that this would be a way to call it, to define it, in countries that can afford it, that have the infrastructure, the funding that's necessary, essentially the means to do global history. Because in some ways, global history is an expensive undertaking. It requires travel, it requires access to funding, it requires language training, which also takes a lot of time and therefore money. So it's not equally easy to do global history, let's say, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and in, you know, maybe some an African university. It's clear that there are crucial limits, and that includes, for example, access to libraries. I mean, that's absolutely also a very crucial issue. So therefore, just descriptively, we can say that global history emerged, you know, sort of in the global north. And it may also, and this would be the second part of the argument, it may also, in the history of the discipline, it has been to some extent also in competition with earlier approaches. That's a discussion that we briefly touched upon at the beginning of the conversation. That is, global history has been seen by some as replacing postcolonial studies. So, for example, I suspect that what some of these colleagues in India also meant when they asked me the question was, we've looked at Indian history through the eyes of empire, and if you now say empire is not the most crucial category, but we need to look at this as a within a global framework, then that may relativize imperial power. It may relativize, to some extent, bracket the hierarchies that imperialism produced. So that, I think, is a second major concern that is in the air. And it's definitely a concern that cannot just simply be swiped away. I think it's a concern that needs to be taken very seriously. I think in many fields, some of the world/global history approaches may run the risk of downplaying these kinds of hierarchies that empire and the age of imperialism brought with them.
I think this also perhaps links to a related point, this idea of English as a powerful language in the writing of global history, and I suppose not even just global history, but much history, and in many academic disciplines overall. What do you think are the political implications of this? And is the dominance of English necessarily always a bad thing?
Well, thank you for that question. That is, again, something that's really at the heart, I think, of this whole debate about the politics of global history. I mean, to say, on the one hand, we can, of course, say that English is, in a way, is just another lingua franca, and the world has seen so many of these lingua francas in the past, right? I mean, Latin or Persian, many others come to mind. So it's not something that's unprecedented. What is unprecedented, however, that it's the first lingua franca that really has a global impact. And in that respect, it is new, and it's obviously also clear that these lingua franca, they are linked to real geopolitical power. To speak in English is one thing, but it's also linked to the political power, in particular of the United States. And that implies that it's linked to particular institutions, norms, sometimes even values that are implicit and are not necessarily recognized as long as we treat English just as one medium for communication. Well, to be a little more concrete here, for example, if scholars who are not from Anglophone countries want to publish in an American or British university press, they frequently need to rewrite what they wrote, something that was entirely appropriate and even cutting edge in their own institutional context, needed to be rewritten in order to be accessible or legible even for an Anglophone audience. So historians who don't write from an Anglophone base, they need to modify what they say. They need to change the historiography that they relate to. They even, in some cases, need to change the style in which they write. I mean, all of that is one, that's just one dimension of it, right? The second dimension is that the terms that we use, they carry so much cultural and historical baggage. And if we use English terms instead of, let's say, Chinese terms, it is very clear that our interpretations are in some ways pre-formatted even before we actually think about them, right? I mean, a term like class or feudalism, terms like revolution or the nation, all of them have a historical baggage that's typically the baggage of Northwestern Europe. And the final point, obviously, is that in any conference, I mean, you've encountered this many times yourself, I'm sure, but in any conference setting, also in the seminar room, I mean, every week by week in my own seminars, there's always the split between the native speakers and those who are not native speakers. It's just much easier for native speakers to say, and they're sometimes convincing, even if the content of what they say is not more convincing than what someone else says, but just by virtue of their language skills. So all of this together is obviously a crucial, introduces a crucial asymmetry into the field of global history. All of that said, now I come to the second part of your question. All of that said, I also believe that without English, it would not necessarily be better. It would probably even be more difficult because it would just not simply not be possible to talk across language boundaries. So in a way, we could say that, we have two evils, but I would also definitely see the benefits and the potential of English as a language that makes it possible to talk across boundaries. I should, however, mention, I just read a recent American Historical Review article by Niall Green, who argues that a very interesting article in which he makes the case that much of our understanding of 19th, 20th century Indian Ocean history has been limited by the fact that historians have essentially just looked at English language publications. And we need to go back to the various vernaculars and actually study them in order to really understand what most people on the ground thought. If that is so, then global historians, and I think he has a point, then global history requires the knowledge of vernaculars. And this is a very roundabout way of saying that also those who come to English as a second language, who have other vernacular languages at their disposal, may have an advantage in this field of global history, because without these vernaculars, global history may become very flat.
Thank you. Now, as we come to the end of the interview, I'd like to think about the future of global history, which you touched on earlier as well. I was fascinated by the provocative statement, I think it's either at the end of the book or you use it to end your book, which was, the gradual disappearance of the rhetoric of the global will then paradoxically signal the victory of global history as a paradigm. So where do you believe global history is going? Are there types of developments we can look forward to? You've discussed the omnipresence of the term global in all kinds of historical work. And do you think there's perhaps a danger that the term has lost precision because of this popularity? Do you think it will potentially disappear, as you suggest? I was wondering if you could elaborate on this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that's a good question. So on the one hand, it is actually striking that global history as a paradigm really became successful without the many struggles that some of the earlier paradigms that we also mentioned, let's say gender history or social history, experienced. There was no real obstacle in the way. There was no real opposition. Yes, I mean, there was skepticism, and there still is. But essentially, so many historians jumped on the bandwagon of the global that global historians were never really forced to precisely spell out what the paradigm is really about. And that has given rise to a situation where we see the term global all over the place. It's ubiquitous. Increasingly, there's a proliferation of texts that claim, you know, the titles of the kind of the history, whatever, the concubine, a global history, the dentist, a global history, and so forth, even if the analyses are not really very global at all. So there's definitely a certain danger here. But we can look at this on a methodological and theoretical level, and there we see potential pitfalls of this wide use of the term. But on the other hand, there's no doubt, I think, that this umbrella term global has changed the discipline to a large degree. If you look at, take just any issue of the, let's say, for example, the American Historical Review, or also past and present for that matter, one of these major journals in the discipline, this year, last year, and then compare with 20 years ago. It is completely different in the geography, in the kinds of articles that are published that are increasingly now about links and connections, not tied to particular places. Also, the conferences, I mean, I remember when I was at the early stages of my career that frequently I was the only token, you know, historian of a non-European place. Now, this is no longer the case. And also in this MA program in which I teach, it is clear that students come together, they focus on all kinds of different places, but they feel themselves part of a shared and joint conversation. So all of this, I think, is wonderful. It is the right direction. And in that sense, the term global has already done a lot. Will it therefore disappear? I think it'll definitely, global approaches will turn mainstream. And that means that at some point we will no longer need to make reference to them all the time. Ultimately, I think it'll be just good history, and history that's less good will be history that is very narrow and doesn't take these connections into account. It would, at this point, still be unconvincing to create an MA program in good history. Therefore, I think institutionally we still need the term global, but 10 years down the road, my suspicion is that the now ubiquitous subtitle, A Global History, will gradually disappear.
Okay, I smiled there. That was funny. So as a last question, do you believe that global history as an academic approach is relevant for audiences outside of universities, outside of the academy? And I was curious if we could conclude by, if I were to ask you, how does global history speak to our present historical moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That's, of course, a very good question, links to the question on the politics of global history. There's this recent and much cited and also much read short piece by Jeremy Edelman where he asks himself, are the days of global history already over? Because we see this surge of populism, of United States and other nations firstism, of xenophobia and so forth around the world. So are the happy days of global history already over? And my response would be, and I think his own response as well, would be, no. First of all, we cannot analyze, we cannot understand the rise of the simultaneous rise of these many populisms or right-wing fundamentalisms outside of a global framework. So we desperately need global history as a way of understanding our present conjuncture. And second, we also need it as a response to narrow-minded nation-firstisms around the world. So therefore, I think global history as an approach is absolutely timely and necessary. But not only because the Orbans and the Trumps and the Dutertes and the Bolsonaros and so forth in this world, but also this was also true 5 years ago, right? It was also true when the global political stage was dominated by the G7 and G20 meetings and the kind of neoliberal politics that included. Also in that context, I think global history is a crucial corrective and sort of a critical device to think about the way in which the world grows together and the way in which we think it should be governed. Finally, I think a good example of this is this recent book last year. I think it appeared in France, the Histoire mondiale de la France, which was read by many French conservatives or nationalists as a as an attack on the integrity of France, the argument that much of French history essentially took place abroad, or that events elsewhere had repercussions and important influence on what happened in France, this larger argument of the book was an intervention into the debate about what and where is France now, what is the role of immigration, what is the role of all kinds of links between France and other parts of the world. So even in this sort of very specific way, I think global history and global history perspectives do have something very substantial to contribute.
Okay, thank you so much. I think that's all we have time for today, but I'd like to thank you so much again for speaking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. On my part as well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for the great questions, and I hope we meet in person soon.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for listening to this second episode of the Global History Podcast with Professor Dr. Sebastian Conrad. If you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com, message us on Facebook, or tweet us at the Global History Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes coming soon.